Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Wild Ginger Running YouTube channel, live broadcast and podcast. Today, we are covering how to go from 50 miles to 100K ultras, so that's 62 miles, with the magnificent, the marvellous, the miraculous coach and physio, Tim Piggott from HP3 Coaching. How are you today, Tim?
Good afternoon, Claire. Hi, hi everybody. Actually, introduction as usual.
This is actually true, though, isn't it, Tim?
Some would say, yeah, bit of story, I suppose, yeah.
Yes, if you haven't heard, I'll have to link to that in the podcast show notes or the film description below. Tim was in a really bad car accident quite a few years ago and is basically now the bionic man. So, yeah, it's fantastic that you're now a sponsored athlete.
Indeed.
And you're about to do Chianti Ultra Trail this weekend. How's that all going?
Off to run 100K in Tuscany, or 103K as it actually is. So, yeah, all good. Just getting packed up, ready to head out. Well, I'll start my travels tomorrow evening. So, yeah, looking forward to it. It should be good. Nice to, hopefully, if all goes well, get some warmer weather and maybe even see some blue sky. You never know.
Yeah, a bit of warmer weather. That will hopefully help you with your asthma-y thing.
Well, yeah, although one of the triggers seems to be pollen. So, of course, it's probably going to be all the pollen out on the trees out there. So we'll see how that one goes.
Yeah.
I just noticed the pollen count is creeping up and it's just starting to irritate my airways, which is a bit annoying after a nice, you know, pretty solid block building up for this race. So we'll see how it goes. I feel okay.
Yeah, see how it goes.
Yes, my voice is possibly just going to go a little bit hoarse, a little bit husky on this chat. So apologies.
Tim with the sexy voice today. Okay, well, I'll have to do lots of talking then. We have had some really nice people watching live. Have had some, Severin says, the adjectives to describe Tim just get better and better. And Peter says, tremendous Tim for future intros. And Severin said, titanium Tim.
Well, indeed, yes. I'm actually talking about the titanium and talking to my wife about what she's going to do if she cremates me. Is she going to sort of melt down my metals and make
like
something
the Terminator
out of it? Yeah, absolutely. But make a piece of jewellery to sort of hang around her neck or something.
Yeah, that would be actually really cool. Yeah, but let's hope that that's not for many, many years.
Indeed.
And hopefully you'll both go together because that would be the best way. Anyway, on that lovely, lovely cheery note, before we start our 50 to 100K training chat, we've just got to do a quick shout out to the sponsor of this episode, who are NAC Sports Nutrition. Ta-da! They make energy bars and waffles and energy recovery powders and real food purees in pouches. And coming soon, bars made with environmentally friendly, sustainable cricket protein. Yummy! I can't wait to try them. In the meantime, I have been using this chocolate and peanut butter bar, both running and actually not running. which could be a problem. I'm surprised there's any left. they're a lovely actual chocolate drops in there, so I really like them. If you want to try any NAC products, like for example, if you're doing one of the UTMB races, which Chianti is actually, isn't it? So if you want to try any ahead of a UTMB race this year, use code WildGingerRunning for 15% off at uk.nac.com. Just a little bit of help for you there, but these are really nice. Right, so 100k. So the reason that we've got you here to chat today is that I feel, Tim, that people often go from like a 50 mile race straight to a 100 mile race. Like there doesn't seem to be loads on the market, loads of races at around that 75, 80 mile marketplace. Seems like it's either 50 miles or 100k or 100 miles. And so 100k being only 62 miles, it's not a very good like bridge. But anyway, I'm going to have a go. I'm going to do Race of the King 100k. Mm-hmm. It's actually 103k, which is 64 miles. So this could be a really short episode, Tim. I mean, does the training for 100k differ for a 50 mile race? Like, because in the book, you know, I've written the Ultimate Ultra Running Handbook. You did the training plans for that, and then I doctored them slightly, and it seemed, and we just grouped them together, didn't we? The 50 miler and the 100k training plans, because it's only 12 miles difference. So we grouped them together. So is there any difference in training for them?
They are certainly going to be very similar in terms of your preparation. I think the difference between 50 mile and 100k is not significant, whereas the difference training for 100k to 100 mile is. And you're right, there aren't many events, or at least it's not a sort of popular distance, that sort of in between, you know, your 75, 80 mile type rate. I mean, there are races out there of that distance. But yes, the sort of, we like these kind of round numbers, 50 miles, 100k, 100 miles. And you're right, you know, a lot of people will jump from a 50k to a 50 mile and then go straight up to 100 mile type distance. And, you know, have you fully learnt your craft? And, you know, a 100k race can take you a long time. So I think rather than focusing on the difference between 50 miles and 60, 62 miles, is more thinking about the specific demands of that distance. You know, I'm thinking about my first sort of 100K versus the 100K I'm going to do this weekend in terms of elevation, terrain, things like that. You know, I'm hoping to probably run this 100K close to twice the speed that I did my first 100K. Now there's a very different course, very different terrain, and somewhat different in terms of fitness, but that's a lesser factor. So I think it's more a case of you've got to be looking at, you know, what is the specific demands of the event you've signed up for? Because you could pick a 50 miler, which is far harder, far tougher in terms of elevation profile, terrain, and take you a lot longer than you then move on to do 100K type distance. So in terms of the kind of training plans, yes, we bunch them together because largely the time durations and training requirements are going to be pretty similar between the two. So, you know, for yourself, you know, Race to the King, it's not as hilly or as challenging as some of the other races you've done. In many ways, one of the challenges of that one is you've got a very flat start to the race. Yeah. There's no
some
sort of
running is involved.
I know, you're gonna have to run.
oh no.
Yeah, so that, you know, adds in some other challenges to it if there is a lot more runnable trail as opposed to enforced walking. So maybe one of the things that I'm apprehensive about this weekend, you know, I like my steep hiking type races, and the one I'm doing this weekend, it's pretty much all runnable. So in terms of kind of the differences there, it's just maybe taking some of those longer runs and just stretching them a little bit more than you would do on your 50 mile training plan, particularly if you are sort of newer to racing these kind of distances or running these kind of distances, just so that you can learn more about your nutrition needs. You know, what's it like when you've been on your feet for, you know, more than just 3 hours? You know, so try and get a couple of those longer 4 hour, 5 hour long runs in there. You might want to put a 50K training race in there as a just a good race simulation where you can test things out, test your nutrition, test your kit, test your mental strategies, things like that. So, you know, that might be the difference. Whereas, you know, for a 50-mile race, do you really need to do a 50K in preparation? No, not really. That's probably going to be pushing your needs a bit too much. You know, for a 50-mile race, doing a trail marathon in training would be a good idea. But you might want to push that out to a 50K when training for a 100K type race. So it's just a gentle shift in that slightly longer for some of those long runs. But a lot of the midweek stuff, particularly for your sort of time crunched athlete, is going to be very, very similar.
Yeah. Yeah. So I totally get what you're saying there about it depends on the 100K, because I've deliberately gone for, to up the distance, I've deliberately gone for an easier 100K, easier in a massive inverted commas. Yeah. It's only got 1,500 and 1,550 metres of ascent, the Race to the King. So yeah, it's a lot gentler than the other 50 milers that I've done. So hopefully, time-wise, it might be similar if I can actually do a bit of running.
Absolutely.
But like, for example, if I had booked the Ultra Trail Snowdonia 100K, that's almost like the Bob Graham round. It's like, you did it last year. It's so hilly, technical, rocky, steep terrain. That would be an absolutely different ball game for 100K. So it very much depends on the race that you book.
Yes.
So my other question was going to be something about, when does the training stop being different from 50 miles? Is it at 70 miles? Is it at 80 miles? Or like, is it at 100 miles? Like, I'm kind of thinking maybe 75 miles, like with, or does it just depend on the race that you book? It just completely depends on the ascent and the technical terrain.
It does. I mean, it really does depend on the specifics of the event as to what the training then needs to look like and, you know, what your own needs are. So in terms of the difference as you're going longer and longer, then, yeah, I think it probably is that going over the 100K, once you're into that sort of 70, 80 mile type range and then into the 100 mile type range, certainly, you know, you're going to be putting a lot more emphasis on, you know, speed hiking. For a lot of the 100K type stuff, one would aim to run as much of that as possible. Whereas as you're going longer and longer, there's just that acceptance that there is going to be a lot of fast hiking in there. Mm-hmm. So we want to make that a real focus of our training as well.
Yeah.
But yes, it really does come down to the specifics of the event. You know, you could argue that Ultra Trail Snowdonia 100K is maybe harder than a lot of 100 milers.
Yeah.
Because of the terrain, because of the elevation, things like that. So, you know, there's...
It's not the distance, basically.
No.
It's more about the ascent, actually, isn't it, on these things? Yeah.
It's your kind of anticipated finish time and what you're needing to do for that.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm like basically on ultras, maybe like 12-minute miling, average, something like that. Maybe less, actually, like as in slower. So I put that into a calculator earlier and it said 13 hours at 12-minute miles to do 65 miles, I think I put it at. But I think 13 hours to do that Race to the King, that's looking very optimistic. So maybe I'm aiming for about 16 hours. So the same as I was aiming for Lakeland 50, really.
Yeah.
So in that case, I'm quite time poor. I think a lot of people watching this will be quite time poor, might not have hills nearby. What training should I do on Monday, on Tuesday, on Wednesday, on Thursday, on Friday, on Saturday, and on Sunday? In a massive nutshell.
It depends on what availability you've got.
I've got an hour to run on a Tuesday. Yep. I've got half an hour to do strength on a Wednesday. This is my sort of routine. Thursday, I have an hour to run as well, and I usually do hills, like 60-second mm-hmm. repeats, five of those I've been doing. Saturday, I can do park run, but I sometimes just don't. And Sunday is my long run day, and I've got like about 3 hours there. Mm-hmm. So it's not a lot. I also do a lot of walking, and general walking with a toddler, and cycling him to nursery and back sometimes.
There you go. Perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that enough?
It'll be enough. You'll make it work.
Yeah, I'll make it round. The cutoffs are really generous on Race of the King. So that's what I'm going for.
The thing about the Threshold Trail series is they are very much focused on, you know, the novice, beginner, just, you know, introduction to trail running, introduction to ultra running. So, yeah, exactly. You know, cutoffs are very generous. Aid stations are usually very well supported, well stocked. So they will put a lot in there to help people get through. So, you know, they are what they are. I've done a couple of their races in the past. I've done Race the Stones twice, and I did the
Race
to the Castle. No, the one up in Northumberland. Oh, okay. They only did it once and then canned it. So, And, you know, I've had some good results on their runs as well.
Yeah, you have. Haven't you podiumed on a few of those ones?
Yeah, I won Race the Stones and came third at Race the Castle.
Cool.
But their events are very much focused on the novice runner and the introductory runners rather than the other way around.
Yeah.
So in terms of your kind of training, a good rule of thumb is your long run at the weekend doesn't want to be more than 50% of your total weekly volume. So what we don't want to be doing is thinking, right, I'll do an hour and a half midweek and I'll do 3 hours at the weekend and try and kind of bump up your mileage that way, because your long run is just going to cause too much fatigue, too much stress, more likely to get injured. So you look at kind of what you can do midweek, and then your long run is at most kind of that again.
Yeah, so double that at the maximum.
At the maximum, yeah. Yeah.
So if I'm doing two and a half hours, then it should be maximum 5 hours, but I won't be doing that.
No. So your weekend run would be, if you did 2.5 hours midweek, you would do a 2.5 hour long run. If you can do 3 hours midweek, you can do a 3 hour long run.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Otherwise, you run the risk of overloading yourself.
Okay. That's a good rule of thumb.
It's a good rule of thumb to start for, because otherwise you do just risk overloading, getting injured, getting sick, because you haven't built up the tissue tolerance to take that kind of load. So if you've got, you know, an hour on Tuesday, then to start with, it's just building up that steady running. You know, if we're looking at Race of the King, you've got to get used to running and not walking for the first kind of, was it about sort of 25-30k or so. So you need to get used to just being able to hold that steady pace. If needed, you can do the kind of run walk method, where you kind of run for 9 minutes, power walk for 1 minute, run for 9 minutes, power walk for 1 minute, or variations on that thing. You know, that's still useful. So that'd be the kind of the first point. You said about doing the sort of hill reps, little short hill reps.
Yeah, 60 seconds. Is that a good idea?
That's really good for just working on your running efficiency, your economy. So working on good form, things like that. So absolutely, building in some hill strides, hill sprints on your Thursday. Yeah, all good. And then, yes, if you then make park run a more regular thing, that could be your kind of tempo run.
Yeah.
And of course, what you can do is, you know, extend it. So make it a run there, do your park run, and then run home again. So you kind of extend it that way with a nice long warm up and a nice long cool down. So you're getting a kind of medium long run on a Saturday. You know, that might be able to stretch it out to an hour or even an hour and a half on the Saturday morning. And then, yes, you can then do your long run on the Sunday. So that's great. And then we've talked about this in the past, but is looking at all these other activities. You mentioned about cycling to nursery. Brilliant. There's some zone zero, zone one additional aerobic conditioning, you know, walking here, walking there. It's all training. It's all beneficial. And it's just trying to clock up those minutes in your week, which are going to give you that good underlying metabolic health and fitness And it's not just about the running fitness as well.
Yeah.
It's all those little things are going to build together.
And I put all those things on Strava as well, like however tiny they are. I'm like, no, I'm putting this walk to the playground on Strava. I'm putting this cycle back a mile to nursery and back on Strava. And often the walking around is weightlifting because Finley weighs about 15 kilograms now. And I'm often carrying him and a scooter if he's, you know, given up the ghost.
Yeah.
So, yes.
So that's it. So
that helps.
Know, carrying that weight, then it means your race pack is going to feel light as a feather compared to him, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. The other thing about Race of the King that is great compared to the Arc, which is the last experience of like proper ultra racing that I've had, is that I won't have to carry much at all.
No.
You have to carry the capacity for 750 mils of water, but I think I might only carry 500 mils because there's checkpoints about every 6 to 9 miles, like every 10 to 15K. Mm-hmm. And they're stocked with loads of things. So I think I'll just take a little clear plastic bag and just scoop a load of stuff in and eat it on the way out. So I'm not going to be carrying like bars and gels and loads of water like the Arc. And, you know, it's not winter either, so I'm not going to be carrying like a huge survival bag and everything. Well, I probably will. But, you know, I'll just carry bare minimum stuff and that will make it easier too. So actually,
yeah, it just depends
it's probably
the...
going to be easier than the Arc 50, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Or the Arc 40, which I'm a massive fan of.
No, absolutely. It should feel a lot easier compared to the Arc. Absolutely. And you're right, you don't need to carry much for these races at all. I mean, when I've done it, I have carried my own nutrition just because I'm a little bit sort of pedantic about what I'm using
special.
And when I'm using
miraculous
it. special I was going to use another word, but let's not put explicit on this podcast. So yeah, absolutely, you don't need to care much at all. I mean, I remember there was a character on the start line of Race of the Stones who was wearing his running shoes and socks, his running shorts. Yeah, he was holding a bottle for water and he had his race number pinned through his nipples. And that was it.
What? Through his nipples?
Yes.
Through his actual nipples?
Yes.
No, that makes me just want to die.
Yeah, apparently it was sort of his party trick that he just sort of pinned his race numbers through his nipples and that was it. And he didn't run with the top.
Oh, my God.
He didn't finish the race. He got lost. Yeah, but he went, I think there's a bit more of a background story to it. But yes, the point is you really don't need to carry much. I was possibly recommend wearing a t-shirt and not
be wearing a bra. I'll sellotape it to my bra.
Yeah, maybe do that. Yeah.
Oh my God, I can't think of anything more horrendous. Already the live comments are coming in. Severine's going, no. I think especially all the women are like, ah.
Yeah, there's some interesting photos out there. But anyway.
Yeah. Was it bleeding then? Or like?
No, I think it's sort of, it, from what I understand, it was sort of his old
piercing.
Part of the rig. And yeah, maybe just using an existing piercing
hole. Because I could put my race number through my ears. Like, that would be fine. That could be my party trick.
Yeah.
Oh, what a mad person. That's so funny that he didn't finish the race, because that would have been a major coup, wouldn't it? If he'd have been mad and finished the race, then you're like, oh, yeah, you'd be mad then. But if you're mad and you don't finish the race, then it's like, oh, well, you're mad.
Yeah. No, he took off like a rocket and disappeared into the distance. And
we thought,
he's either going to smash the course record or blow up. And then he overtook me twice.
Yeah.
Having got lost. apparently he did after that one. But anyway,
yeah.
I think he went back again, but I'm not sure whether he did finish the second time.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're going off on a tangent.
Yeah. Well, Sabrine says at least he was wearing shorts. And Tadeusz says that sounds like a medieval penitent. So yeah, it does sound like a punishment there. So there's generous cutoffs. We don't need to sprint off at the beginning.
No.
I don't know if I'll need poles. I'm guessing yes, because it's going to be a long time. So I think I might just take poles and carry them to start with so I can properly run along and then get them out when the going gets tough, maybe.
No, I mean, for that event, you've got the, the hills on the sort of second half, I suppose, or second two thirds of the race. But it's not a lot of elevation. So the hills, they're not that steep. They don't go on for that long. So you need to weigh up whether the carrying the extra weight is worth mm-hmm. the benefit of some of those hills.
Yeah.
So it's an individual choice. I mean, there will be plenty of people that will use poles, and there'll be plenty of people that don't. So it is very much a personal preference. I've just got to link it back to the Ridgeway. The Threshold Trail series got their Race of the Stones. The last time I raced on that was the full length of the Ridgeway Challenge. And I didn't use poles, but the guy who finished just behind me, he did.
Okay.
There were maybe one or two occasions I thought, oh, I wish I had a pair of poles with me. But that's kind of literally a few hundred metres out of 100 Ks. Or no, that was 80-odd miles, wasn't it? So kind of 120-odd Ks.
Yeah.
So it's a very, very personal thing as to whether you do or not.
Yeah.
Well, you know, this weekend, Chianti, I'm taking my poles with me out there, but I'm not sure whether I'm going to race with them or not. I need to kind of get eyes on the ground and just sort of get a better feel for what those hills look like when I do a few little mini recces out there. It is very much 50-50 as whether you need them or not.
Yeah, I suppose if you think you're going to be walking that last 20 miles, then poles would be really super useful. But if I'm going to be trying to jog along, then maybe not. And also, whenever I have poles, I do love using poles, but if I'm filming the race with a GoPro and then trying to also feed myself and then maybe trying to look at some directions on my phone, it's just like, what do I do with all these things in my hand? It sort of needs like a shelf here to put everything on. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Peter says on the live broadcast, he says, on the live comments, he says, from when is it useful to have poles? Is it distance or elevation, etc.? I think it's a combination, isn't it? So, and terrain.
Yeah, terrain, obviously. The steepness of the vert. So once we're going above really 20% incline, that's where poles are definitely useful.
Yeah.
But you need to be practiced. So you need to be efficient and drilled in using them. Otherwise, you'll find that the energy cost of using poles outweighs the benefit and you'll end up going slower.
Yeah.
Because you're not skilled in using them. So, so it is generally the kind of steeper climbs, then they are definitely useful. The shallower gradients, they are still useful, but it's a question of, again, how good are you in terms of your rhythm and your coordination, and how strong is your upper body for using them, and therefore how much energy are you going to be burning using your poles as well?
Yeah. I've got a 40-miler on the 7th of April, a Coventry Way, which is kind of similar in terms of not very hilly. It might be quite muddy. But I'm thinking now, maybe if I don't use poles on that, or if I give them my mum and dad, because I'm from Coventry, my mum and dad are going to bring Finley to come and support me. So I could give them my poles. So if I, at 20 miles, go, oh, actually, I really do want the poles, they could give them to me then. So that could be quite a good test race for whether to use poles or not without actually having to carry them all the way around and risk not using them.
Depending on what the race rules are.
Yeah, it's an LDWA, Long Distance Walkers Association race. So it's like...
They may not rules. Be bothered. Yeah.
They don't care. Yeah. I'm not going to win, so they're not going to care, I don't think. Yeah.
A lot of races will be that if you start with poles, you have to carry them all the way through. You can't pick up a part way, or you can't drop them after you've done the hills and therefore do it the way.
Yeah.
That's it. Maybe kind of give yourself the goal of doing it without and see how you cope. And, you know, if you get towards the end and you're just thinking, oh, I wish I had my poles.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that'll kind of answer the question for you.
Yeah.
For somebody like yourself, because you have a deeper background in hiking, hill walking, Nordic walking, essentially, so you're far more used to fast hiking with poles, then you'll find that, you know, they probably are more beneficial for somebody like yourself compared to somebody else who hasn't got that kind of background, isn't as proficient in fast hiking with poles, and we'll find that actually the poles just get in the way, they trip over, end up slowing you down, taking more energy, you're then not eating and drinking often because your hands are full. like I say, it is an individual thing.
Yeah, it's really individual, yes. And it takes a few races to get the hang of it, really. And no one else will be, like, presumably not many other people are doing it with a GoPro, so you don't have to worry about that kind of side of things. But everybody is eating. So I met a few people on the ARC that said they didn't take poles on the ARC because it stopped them from eating. And that was a problem for them. So, yeah.
Yeah, so again, it's just practicing how to, you know, quickly just put one pole in one hand, or both poles in one hand, rather, and then you've got that free hand for getting your drink, getting your gel, bar, whatever it's going to be, and just practicing that in training.
Yeah.
I did a run last week where it was just running around the forest trails, but the purpose for that run was just to practice getting poles out, put the poles away again, mm-hmm. get the poles out, put them away again, all while still running.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the other thing is people take their poles, but then they stop, they stand still, they get their poles out, they sort themselves out, they get going, need to put the poles away, stop, unfold the poles, try and put them away. And you're bleeding 30 seconds plus each time you're doing that. Or you're running along holding the poles in your hand.
Yeah.
And if you just hold anything in your hand, that increases your energy costs of running.
Yeah.
So, you know, you want to try and keep that weight closer to your body, not out in your hands.
Yeah.
And even running with poles, it will just change your arm action a little bit, and it will affect your running mechanics and your running energy costs. So if you are using poles, you need to practice how to get them out and put them away again while still running, or at least fast walking.
Yeah.
But I think really the decision for using them is, if the terrain is going to be steep and challenging, you want to have poles. I was joking with some of the Scarpa athletes the other week. Some of them went out and raced the snow sky running series of races out there, sort of running up ski slopes. And the joke was, you know, spot the Brits, because they're the only ones without poles.
Yeah.
Because they're just used to fell running.
Yeah, and you're not allowed actually on fell races, are you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So spot the fell runners, spot the Brits compared to all the Europeans with their ski poles. So anyway,
Yeah, definitely. Yes, the Europeans love their ski poles, don't they? Even when it's not snowing. I have got a couple of questions on the live.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Been alerted to. Lloyd, one of our patrons, has been struggling with some fatigue recently, and he's wondering whether it is related to electrolytes. Do you have any thoughts on, because he trains for ultras a lot, how often he should consume electrolytes? Like, is it every session or is it just on a race? He's a vegan, I think. He eats fairly whole foods, but that means, because it's like no processed food, it's pretty low in sodium. He says he's experimenting to see if using electrolytes improves things. He's had a precision hydration salt test, and he's a normal level salty sweater. So for races, he usually has a tab on every drink regardless.
Mm-hmm.
So he's been suffering with some fatigue lately.
So obviously there's lots of reasons for fatigue. Is it looking at overall training structure in terms of the balance between training and rest and recovery? Is it about giving the body enough energy, so eating enough? And if you are following any form of sort of dietary philosophy, then where you are cutting out or removing any form of food products from your diet, then you do need to pay very careful attention to, you know, are you getting sufficient not only macronutrients but micronutrients. So, you know, the risk of being deficient in any area then does go up. So if you are, you know, following any form of dietary philosophy there and finally getting some issues, then the best thing to do is actually speak to a dietitian or nutritionist who can then give you some more detailed advice there. You know, it might be, you know, if the fatigue issues are ongoing, that it's even worth having a chat with your GP, your doctor, and getting some blood tests done just to check on, you know, things like your iron levels, your vitamin D levels, that type of thing. You know, if you're not eating animal products, then it is a challenge to get sufficient iron in your diet because the bioavailability of iron from plant sources is not as good. So it's looking at that, for example. You know, that'd be one area, and making sure that you're eating your iron-rich foods with a source of vitamin C as well, to kind of increase that absorption rate. So there's probably things to explore there. In terms of electrolytes, the evidence base around electrolytes for sport is very mixed. You know, do you need to take additional electrolytes when exercising or not? And you will get people arguing strongly on both sides of that argument. And I think really the truth is it depends on the individual. There are some people who do need to take additional electrolytes, and there are some people that can survive perfectly well with just getting their salts from their diet and only taking water on during exercise. So you'll hear arguments on both sides of that spectrum, and I think they're probably both right, but for different reasons and for different people. So, you know, if you know you are a relatively sweaty exerciser, salty sweater, and you've tried taking some of the Precision Fuel and Hydration tablets, so, you know, maybe some of the 1,000 milligram tablets in your water, how's that working out for you? Is that helping? And if it does seem to help, great, you know, that might be the thing to do. It might be a case of just, yes, getting a little bit more salt into your normal diet and see whether that helps as well. But again, that's probably something that, you know, if you are getting ongoing issues, be worth doing under the supervision of a nutritionist or even a dietitian.
Have you got nutritionists and dietitians as in your HP3 coaching as well, Tim?
Yeah, indeed. I'm not sort of pushing the marketing, but yes. So
that's the whole point of you being here.
Yes.
Tim has people for you to talk to, Lloyd, if you want
Absolutely,
to pop in.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm a nutrition coach. I'm not a nutritionist. But I've got Liz, who's our nutritionist, and also got Howard, who works with us as well. So if more detailed dietary analysis and support is required, then yeah, I can refer you to one of the team there if that needs more detailed support.
And you're sponsored by Precision Hydration as well, aren't you?
I am, yeah. So I'm supported by them. So yeah, you know,
that's what you use.
I know that exactly. You know, I know that I run better by taking some additional salts on board, and that works for me. So, whereas I know other people will say, oh, no, you don't need to. But it's probably just that they don't need to.
Not that you don't need to. Yeah,
exactly. It's not a kind of, it's not a black and white answer to that question. That's the problem.
Yeah. Well, Lloyd's put a big thumbs up to that. So I think he was happy with that answer. And in a similar vein, we've got another patron called Christian, Christian Poulton, who I met at the Arc of Attrition. Mm-hmm. He did very well on the 50 miler. He said he's still struggling with his eating and drinking on the longer races. So up to 50K, he says he's fine. But then after 50K, so like anything he's just done, he's just amazingly done Eco Trail Paris, which is 82 miles. And you finish on the first story of the Eiffel Tower. So like after all that running, like after like pretty much 80 miles, you've got to climb all these steps up to the first story of the Eiffel Tower, which just sounds amazing. Congratulations, Christian, for doing that. But he's saying that he finds it difficult after 50K to eat and even drink. On the last 80K, he ran the last 10K on fumes and adrenaline. He wasn't able to eat anything or drink anything. So he's got a couple of 100Ks coming up later this year, and he's really worried about this. He also finds that after the race, he's lightheaded and nauseous. He can't face food until he's had a chance to lie down for a while. And he feels like this for most races over a marathon. Gosh, it sounds like you need to slow down, Christian, and have a little rest.
Well, that might be one issue, is actually going too hard. Because if you're going too hard, then all the blood's getting pumped to your muscles and you're not getting it going to your guts. So you can't process what you're taking on board. So the question is, you're taking on board drinks, gels, bars, food, whatever it is, but are you processing it? Is your stomach actually doing anything with it, or is it just sitting there because you haven't got the blood flow going to your stomach and your intestines to deal with it? So if your gut slows down, your gut motility slows down, you can't process what you're putting in. It'll just going to build up until you can't get anything else down and you either vomit it all back up or, yeah, you just feel nauseous. So that might be the first question is, you know, are you running your 50Ks at the same effort you run your marathons at? And is that where maybe some of the issues are coming in? Are you training your gut? So starting off in training and, you know, dropping the number of carbs per hour right down and then just slowly building up the number of carbs an hour you're taking. So it might be you start doing your long runs and you aim to take 40 grams of carbs an hour on board. Okay, stomach can cope with that, fine. Right, now I'll try and do 50 grams an hour, then 60, 70, 80, 90, whatever you get up to. Find that point where you kind of hit your limit of I can't take any more on board, and then knock it down a level to where you were comfortably taking on board that type of carbohydrate. Something else to consider is taste fatigue. So is it a physiological thing, or is it more of a psychological thing of just like, I am bored of taking on gels. I really can't stomach another gel. It's making me feel sick. And it's possibly more just because of that taste fatigue. So that's where changing the flavors up, trying to get something in there which is, you know, quite strong or quite sharp. So a lot of our sports products are very sweet in tasting. So getting something in there that's quite sharp. So a kind of very sharp lemon or lime type flavour. As well, I use the kind of the chews, lemon and lime chews, just to kind of change the flavour up a little bit.
And your fisherman friends?
Fisherman friends, yeah. Just
good
to kind
fishy
of really
flavor there.
Clear the palate. or this is where the kind of more, you know, real food can come in as well, just to give yourself a little bit more satiety in terms of your stomach. So, you know, I use the Supernatural fuel pouches just for blended up real food, easy to get down. But again, it just gives your stomach something non-sweet. I quite like the sort of earthier flavours of some of the Supernatural fuels, just to change it up so you're not just taking on sweet all the time. So I think that's worth considering as well. If you're going sort of very heavy on the sugars in the first part of the race, then again, that might be where you're starting just to shut down and say, right, I don't want any more of that. So it might be better that you start on more complex, real food in the sort of first part of the race and then start to shift to simpler and simpler carbohydrates throughout the second part of the race.
Yeah, well, I hope that's helpful for Christian. Yeah, he's doing a lot of racing this year, so I think that would be really helpful for him.
I mean, going back to the sort of first question actually around electrolytes is, you know, if you are somebody that, you know, if Christian's not using electrolytes in his fluids, that might be something to look at, because it might be that he's not actually able to absorb that water particularly well, and it's just building up in the stomach, and that's where just then feeling full and nauseous. Whereas actually maybe adding some electrolytes into the fluids can help with that absorption and get that into the bloodstream rather than just building up and sitting in the stomach. So there's different things, and is one of those where, you know, Christian needs to try some different strategies in training and see what works.
Yeah, and then because you don't really train beyond like 20 or 30 miles, do you? And that's when he starts to have the problem. So he'll have to train on the races as well. So pick some races to do that are like, oh, I'm just going to try experimenting with this on this race.
Yeah, and you know, what you could certainly do is, you know, do a really detailed reflection on, you know, for example, the Eco Trail being very fresh in the mind. You know, what did you eat and when? And really trying to work out the calculations, you know, how many carbohydrates an hour were you taking on board? It might be trying to eat too much and actually just the body wasn't able to process all of that energy, all that carbohydrate that he was trying to take on board. And maybe that was the issue. But anyway, I think there's the thing to do is really do a deep dive analysis on, you know, what you did in that last race. When did you start to feel nauseous? Can we then try and identify any kind of causation and sort of correlation there? It's difficult, but we can try. And then try and work out a strategy to not repeat the same.
Yeah, good shout. I think Christian will be definitely doing that. And we've got a couple more questions from patrons as well that people sent in. So Alex says, this is the opposite problem to a lot of people that listen to the channel. So this is very interesting. She lives in a very hilly place. So does she need to do actual hill rep sessions that I keep banging on about that I have to do around here? Or should she focus on finding flatter terrain for things like fartleks and strides instead, seeing as she's always running up and down hills anyway? Thanks, Alex.
Yeah, depends on what you're training for, I suppose.
That's your answer to everything, Tim. I love it.
It is. It
depends what race you're training for.
Yeah, I mean, I've got, one of my athletes who is actually training for Manchester Marathon, but lives in a very hilly, mountainous part of France. And the challenge is finding flatter kind of road type surfaces to do her marathon long runs on, just to get used to actually running on the flat, because otherwise it's all kind of running downhill, fast hiking up a hill, run downhill, fast hike up. If you are picking a flat race, then you might want to go off and try and find some flatter terrain. But on the whole, the saying up in the lakes is no easy miles. And anything on the flat doesn't count. If you're training for hilly terrain and hilly races, fantastic, crack on. You know, do you need to run up and down the same hill repeatedly? Not necessarily. If you can do a loop which takes in lots of different hills, fine, that works. I think we try and get very clinical with some of our training and repeating the same effort over and over again on the same bit of hill. But you don't have to. You can just make it a hilly loop and just do a bit of a, you know, fartlek. So, yeah, you run harder up some hills and you run easy on the downs, or mix it up. So, yeah.
I wonder if it, because I sort of replied a little bit to Alex and said, oh, well, we'll see what Tim says. But I was just thinking about it's the way you run up the hill. So if you live in a hilly place, but you're just sort of like jogging up the hills, then that can be steady. But then if you make an effort on those hills and really push on, say, five of them, then that's your hill session, isn't it? So it's that kind of thing. It's the intensity with which you attack the hill.
Exactly. You know, I've got a fairly long hill that I use for both hard efforts, tempo efforts, and easy efforts.
Yeah.
Because, you know, some of the races I go and do, I could be running up a hill for an hour. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's up out into the mountains or so, but there's no hills around here that I could run uphill for an hour. But I also need to train myself for the intensity of going uphill and the mechanics of running up a hill, but at an easy ultra intensity. So I'll do easy aerobic hill reps where you're not out of breath, it's just cruising up a hill, but it's just getting used to that specific style of running.
And if she wants to do, like, I think we've covered fartleks really, because you can do what you like in a fartlek, but like with strides, would she be wanting to find a bit of flatter terrain to do some strides on? The strides being, you know, 15 or so seconds of running flat out, taxing your legs but not your lungs.
Depends what you want to achieve. So you could be doing hill strides. So it's, again, the mechanics of running up a steep hill, the mechanical movement patterns are very similar to speed running on the flat, but you haven't got the same impact forces running uphill because the ground is closer to you when your foot then comes back down again because you're going up a hill. So actually the kind of impact forces through the legs are less when you're doing hill strides compared to strides on the flat. So hill strides can be very, very useful. It could be, if she wants to work on speed, is do some downhill reps, you know, find a nice gradual downhill and do your strides running downhill. Use gravity, free speed, over speed running.
Yeah.
That can be very useful as well.
Well, Alex is listening live and she says she will be training for a 56K in August. So I suppose what you really need to know in that 56K is the ascent, like how hilly is it going to be? Because that dictates how much effort you put in on those hills.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
So yeah, if it's a hilly 56K, then go for the hills. And if it's not, then find some less hills.
Well, yeah, but then also
get your treadmill.
run the hills, and then you'll just find the flat is so easy. Yeah. It's brilliant. Yeah.
Excellent. And just while we were talking about hydration, I missed a question from Peter, who said he often gets headaches after his long runs, and he's wondering if that is to do with dehydration, because he's reduced his caffeine intake during runs to try and help this. But yeah, do you think he could be dehydrated, or maybe lack of electrolytes, as you were saying?
I mean, yeah, it could be dehydration if not taking anything on board. You know, think about what's your pre-run hydration like. Are you maintaining good hydration status in the rest of your day, or are you finding you're getting dehydrated at certain times? You know, short-term dehydration in your run is not a major issue, as long as you then rehydrate afterwards. You know, if we're looking at marathon runners, the fastest marathon runners will be the most dehydrated on the finish line. But short-term dehydration is not a major problem. It's looking at more, chronic and long-term, or for the much, much longer races, that's where it becomes more of a factor.
Yeah, okay, so that should be okay. Just drink a bit more. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Alex says thank you and a smiley face. And then a final question from Kat. She says she's bought a fancy Garmin and she would like to know more about HRV. Why is it measured at night? As an evening exerciser, mine tends to be lower after my running evenings, presumably a temporary response to exercise stress, but it also varies wildly across the night. I'd like to know more about this next time you have a fellow geek as a live chat guest. So you are our fellow geek today, Tim.
Okay.
What do we need to know about HRV? Because I had to look it up. I was like, what?
Yeah, heart rate variability. Okay. That is an episode in itself.
Heart rate variation. Okay, yeah, well, shall we do the next episode on HRV? Is it useful for us to know?
Yeah, or I can put you in touch with some people to maybe do a specific podcast on, if you particularly want.
Well, it's a useful thing. I mean, like, I'm very not techie at all, but then again, I don't get on the podium ever, so you know.
So in short, I'll try and keep this really short because we're approaching the hour already. So it's looking at the heart rate variability, so it's looking at the gaps in between your heartbeats. So rather than just counting how many beats per minute your resting heart rate is, it's looking at the variability and the gaps in between, because your heart rate isn't absolutely regular. It's not boom, boom, or ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum. There's variations in that. And what this is looking at is how well your autonomic nervous system is recovering and what your parasympathetic nervous system activity is like. And we're really trying to measure your stress levels, physiological stress levels, and whether you are recovered or not, or whether you're being sort of dampened down. So we look at this variability to then come up with a score. Now, there's different wearables out there in terms of measuring your heart rate, variability, and then using some form of algorithm to give you what that information then sort of means, if it means anything at all. And that's the kind of more controversial bit. So I personally use an app called HRV for training. So if you wanted to speak to anybody, I'd thoroughly recommend you talk to Marco, who set that up. And that's giving you his algorithm, I would say the better one out there. More usable in terms of what those numbers then mean. The Garmin, again, it depends on the information that you get from this depends on the quality of the data going in. So if it's just taken off your watch and, you know, the optical sensor on your watch, well, the question is, how accurate is that data? is your watch really, really tight on your wrist so there is zero movement going on? Because as soon as there's any movement between your watch and your skin, that data is next to useless.
Okay.
Then it's looking at, again, other products out there. So you've got things like the Oura Ring. So again, it's a ring with an optical sensor to measure your heart rate that way. That one's okay. You've then got things like Whoop, so the band that you wear. All the scientific studies looking at Whoop basically say Whoop is useless. Don't bother using it. So sorry.
I thought that from the marketing.
It's one of the. I think the sad thing is Whoop have a very good user interface. So their app, everything else is nice and it's pretty. It's very usable, but the data going in is garbage. So it doesn't really give you usable information. So the general advice from the scientific community is look at the raw data. Don't believe the recovery scores, the readiness scores, these type of messages that you get from your wearable, whether that's your Garmin, your Ring, your Whoop, your whatever. It's taking that raw data and feeding that into a much broader decision making in terms of, yeah, so how do you feel in yourself? You know, what's your mood like? What was your sleep like? What was your stress in terms of, you know, travel or nutrition, alcohol intake, all these other factors that will build into it. So it's not just taking this one metric of what your HRV number is on that any given day. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit more complicated. Then there was the question about why is it taken at nighttime versus other times of the day. We're moving out of my area of expertise now. I think with Garmin, it's probably more the fact that you're less likely to be moving around a lot at nighttime, and therefore that's where it takes its measurements from. Whereas if you're measuring it sort of manually, then the advice is usually to take it in the morning after waking up. So there are some differences between morning HRV versus evening or nighttime HRV. And there's so many other factors that there's even things like whilst you're measuring your HRV, if you swallow, that will mess up your data.
Oh,
exactly.
It sounds so, like you just need to pay attention to how you feel, doesn't it? Like I never, my watch is always telling me stuff. It's always coming up with like, oh, you've exercised today, so you need to do this. Oh, you've got 12 hours till you're free. And I'm like, I just ignore it. I'm like, go away, yeah, watch. You don't know anything. I just, you know, how does it know?
I do like my Garmin. But the messages it gives you, ignore.
I don't like the algorithm for some reason. Yeah, I just feel like it's bossing me around. I'm like, I will tell you when I'm going for my next run, Garmin.
It is useful, but it's only one piece of information in the overall picture.
Yeah.
So it gives you a bit of a quantitative bit of data to feed into that decision making. So there's also the qualitative of how do I feel, what's my mood like. But then yes, you can then be looking back and see, well, how many hours of sleep did I get, what's my resting heart rate, what's my HRV, and building all this in together to decide on, you know, if you wake up and you just think, I'm not 100% today, do I train, don't I train, but everything else is green across the board, well, maybe, yeah, crack on. But if you wake up and you're thinking, oh, I'm just not quite feeling 100% today, and your HRV is depressed, your heart rate's a bit elevated, that just gives you a bit more data to go, yeah, you're not being soft. Maybe, mm-hmm. maybe you do just need to take a chill day, maybe just go for an easy run. Or, yeah, if it's significantly off, then that might be the decision to go, actually, I'm just going to take a full rest day. I'm not going to do that run. I'm not going to do that interval session. I'm going to take a full rest day. And then that stops you digging a hole.
Yes. Yeah. Well, Kat's watching live and she says, thanks. That's really helpful. She generally ignores her watch versus how she feels, but it's good to hear it from you guys. Yes. Yeah. Oh, don't listen to me, Kat. I know nothing.
Yeah. If you want to be that,
this is why Tim's here.
I'd have a look at HRV4, and it's the number 4. training.com, And yes, it's about their app, but he's got loads of really good articles, a lot of research papers, so scientific peer-reviewed research papers telling you about HRV and how you can use that. On Twitter, no, X as it is, Sean Allen, so S-A-I-N-A-L-L-E-N, Sean Allen, researcher on wearables and health metrics. So again, she's a really sound person to listen to when it comes to that. So, you know, proper scientific rather than bro science and marketing.
Yes, yeah. I love that term, bro science. Yeah, awesome.
Yeah.
Well,
hopefully that kind of at least points in the right direction.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully that helps you, Kat. I think it has. I think you've helped a lot of people on this podcast today too, and we've had loads of like comments. You've answered loads of things there, and you've really helped me with my 100K training for Race the King as well. So thanks for that. Just got to do a quick thank you for the sponsors. Mm-hmm. Thanks to NAC Sports Nutrition for sponsoring the live broadcast and podcast. I'm looking forward to eating more of these delicious bars and the waffles. And especially, I'm going to start testing out the energy drink powder on the Coventry 40, which is my next event on the 7th of April. If you want to try some, use code WILDGINGERRUNNING for 15% off at uk.nac.com. And Tim, you've got some training plans and stuff for us on a special link, haven't you, in Training Peaks. Maybe yeah. It's a good idea to add a 100K training plan to that. Like, is that something that we can do from this?
I actually added one.
Oh, have you done that already?
Last week? No, somebody was asking about a recovery, sort of some guidance on recovery after their race. So I've actually added another training plan onto that for sort of post event recovery.
Yeah.
So that was off one of your listeners. So yeah, absolutely. We can add in some more kind of 100K and some other races onto that. So yeah, if anybody's got sort of particular wishes, any particular events, and you're wanting just an off the shelf training plan to help you guide there, you don't need one to one coaching. You just want a specific plan. We can do that, and we put it up on your Wild Ginger Running store, and you can purchase that. If anybody does want one-to-one coaching and far more detailed support there, then yeah, within the team we've got a number of spaces available with either myself or the other coaches on the squad. So yeah, get in touch and we can help you out.
Awesome, that is fantastic. And would people just contact you on Instagram or in the Wild Ginger Running Facebook page and tag you because you're in there?
Yeah, either. Yeah. I try and pick up any tags on your patrons group or the general Wild Ginger Running group. Or yes, absolutely, get in touch with me via Instagram or again, email address. You can contact me at info@hp-3.co.uk or find me on all the usual socials.
Yes.
And I think you put my details in the bottom of these things.
Yeah, I do. I put all Tim's details if you want to know anything about Tim, including his amazing backstory. I'm sure we did one of our first episodes, wasn't it? We talked about your car crash and your recovery from there.
We have, yes.
Yeah, so I'll have to relink to that at some point as well, because it is just fantastic that you've come so far and you're doing all this elitism now, which is brilliant. But that's fantastic. It's always fantastic to chat to you, Tim.
Next time
you will be Titanium Tremendous Tim, I think, as we introduce you, based on Peter and Severin's comments.
Yeah. Yeah.
But good luck this weekend at Chianti Ultra Trail. I hope you do really, really well.
Thank you very much. Yeah, should be good.
Awesome. Bye, everybody. Thanks for watching.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.